From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
One of the big arguments about last week's budget is whether it's discriminatory in gender terms. Critics claim it neglects women because much of the assistance favours male-dominated sectors of the economy. Anthony Albanese, in his budget reply, said women have suffered most during the pandemic, but were reduced to a footnote in the budget. His budget reply promised a generous reshaping of childcare to help women who want to work or to work more hours. This week, we're joined by Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute, a leading independent think tank, to discuss the gender debate around the budget. Wood is president of the Economic Society of Australia and co-founder and former chair of the Women in Economics Network, and has published extensively on economic reform, budget policy, tax reform, childcare and inequality. Danielle Wood, from an economic standpoint, what did you think of the budget generally? Is the government doing enough to speed up the recovery?
Look, I think they've made the right choice in fundamentally changing their fiscal strategy and concentrating on stimulating demand and jobs. And in terms of the scale of the response, I think it really does line up fairly well with the very significant challenge we face. My overarching concern is that they really have bet the house on the idea of a private sector-led recovery. So all the, you know, big measures in the budget, changes in the tax treatment of capital investments, the wage subsidy for younger workers, personal income tax cuts, all rely on, you know, business confidence going out there to invest, consumers having the confidence to go out there and spend. And I think there is a risk, given the high level of uncertainty in the economic environment, that they just won't do that. So it could pay off, but my concern is that, you know, we have put our eggs really into that private sector basket. And if it doesn't pay off, then we may see unemployment sticking around for a long time to come.
So you're saying the amount spent is okay, but it's how it's spent that you're worried about?
That's right. So, you know, I think you could imagine a budget with a similar quantum of spending, but with a slightly different mix of spending that would make you feel more confident in the likelihood of a recovery. And, you know, as we'll probably come to, you know, better targets the sectors that are hard hit in this recession.
So what's the alternative to relying on the private sector? Do you put out more cash payments or more infrastructure spending? Where do you put the money if you're not relying on the private sector?
So there are other things you can do on the consumption side. So we've put the money into tax cuts. Cash payments can be more effective. The most effective at all is actually things like vouchers or government-funded discounts. The reason for that is every dollar hits the economy. It can't be saved. And you can target the sectors that are hardest hit. So we see overseas, for example, in the UK, they're running discount schemes to encourage people to dine out. Some of the state governments in Australia are having voucher schemes for local tourism. So those types of schemes are actually incredibly effective at underpinning consumption. The other, you know, big thing that governments could do, I think, is more directly invest in services. So there has been quite a sizable infrastructure spend in the budget, but a lot of that is going to transport infrastructure, which has already got a pretty healthy pipeline. So probably, again, not the part of the economy that really needs the fillip. On the other hand, you know, spending on services, aged care, childcare, that actually creates more jobs per dollar spent and delivers something socially useful.
You've used the term blokey budget. What do you mean by this?
What I mean is that where we look at those areas that have received direct support, construction, I've already mentioned, energy sector, defence, manufacturing, all of those areas where the government has put direct money into a particular sector, they tend to be male-dominated sectors. And actually, often they're not the ones that have taken the hardest hit in this recession. On the other hand, you know, the sectors that have been hit really hard, hospitality, tourism, the arts, recreation, administrative services, tend to be actually slightly more female dominated, still employ a lot of men as well. But, you know, we really don't see any direct assistance for those sectors in the budget.
What about the stage two tax cuts that have been brought forward? Are they blokey?
I haven't cut the numbers on those. So certainly when we looked at the stage three, because they were much more skewed to high income earners, I think about 2/3 of the benefit of the stage three cuts will go to men. It will not be so pronounced for the stage two cuts because they are more evenly spread across the income distribution. My guess is that they probably do skew towards men, but not in as stark way as the stage three cuts will.
How important is it, or relevant is it, to look at tax cuts through a gender prism? Scott Morrison, for example, said when he was treasurer, and I quote, "You don't fill out pink forms and blue forms on your tax return." So is this way of looking at it valid, do you think, a gender prism?
Look, I think it's important to look at the budget as a whole. You know, tax cuts are one measure in a much broader budget, but bringing a gender lens is important, and it's only one lens that you bring to looking at things. But we need to remember that men and women start from very different positions economically. They felt the COVID recession in quite different ways economically. And so looking through a gender prism just makes sure that a group that has been particularly hard hit doesn't get left behind. And, you know, remember, women are 50% of the population. So I think, you know, thinking about this in a gendered way can be helpful to make sure you haven't sort of missed things that are important. And, you know, that's what I'm really saying here, that I think the absence of that lens has actually led to some decision making which isn't in the best interests economically and particularly for women.
Now, Labor's made childcare a centrepiece of its budget statement. The Coalition did not. Anthony Albanese has committed to a much more generous childcare arrangement that would cost more than $6 billion over several years. That would help the parents concerned, obviously, but how would it help the economy?
So in the short term, it's really important for the economic recovery. We have very high out-of-pocket childcare costs in this country. And what that's meant as families have lost jobs or they've lost hours, a lot of them just can't afford to keep their children in care. So we see parents pulling their children out of care. As jobs start to come back and as the economy recovers, if you've lost your care place, it can be hard to have that flexibility to take work or hours as they become available. So it's sort of preventing people from being jobs ready. That's going to be particularly women who we know end up usually as the primary carer. So it's very important for the recovery. It's also a really important, you know, I think of it as a long-term economic reform. Again, those high out-of-pocket costs create a big work disincentive, particularly beyond 3 days a week. And our work suggests that for a lot of women, you know, right across the income distribution, you know, once they work 3 days, if they're looking at going for a fourth or fifth day, after additional tax, after any clawback of family assistance benefits and those childcare costs, they're often working for virtually nothing or even for free on a fourth or fifth day. So we have a lot of women that choose, in inverted commas, to work 3 days a week, but really that's the way in which our system is pushing them. We expect if you actually provide a return for work by reducing those childcare costs, you'll see more women choose to work more. And, you know, that obviously grows the productive capacity of the economy.
And how big might the eventual boost to the economy be through such reforms?
So our numbers suggest that for every dollar that you spend reforming the subsidy, and that's, you know, reducing the base rate, but also less aggressively means testing so that people have an incentive to earn more, you return more than $2 in additional GDP. So, you know, the labour reforms, you know, you're probably talking, if it's $2 billion a year, you know, something in the vicinity of $5 billion return each year for GDP.
Now, everyone seems to have their own numbers. I note that Bob Brunick, who's director of the ANU's Tax and Transfer Policy Institute, argues that overall productivity gains from boosting childcare, which incidentally he's not against on other grounds, but he says that those overall gains would be marginal. Do you think he's wrong? And if so, why?
So we didn't factor any productivity gains into those numbers. So that's all about increased workforce participation. So more people working more hours. I suspect he is wrong on productivity. And the reason I say that is, you know, when we think about the group that are probably going to be coming into the workforce under these reforms, you know, it's right across the income distribution. We have very highly trained female workforce. You know, women have been graduating from universities in greater numbers than men for a number of decades now. So I suspect it may well bring up average productivity, but I should say that, you know, none of our numbers are prefaced on that idea. It's purely a participation effect only. If you do get a boost in productivity on top of that, that would only add to the economic benefits that I'm talking about.
Under the Labor plan, higher earning parents would do much better than they have been doing out of the childcare arrangements. Is that a concern?
No, I don't think it is a concern, you know, particularly when you start looking at this through an economic reform lens. The reason that is the case is that you're making that means test less aggressive. So as the second earner, who's still generally the woman, increases her hours, you don't claw back the subsidy as aggressively. So that's, you're doing that specifically to create those incentives to work. It does mean that some higher income earners will get a bigger subsidy. But I think if you look at it as an economic reform and you look at the broader returns from that, as well as the longer term benefits for women's economic security, you know, I think this is a reform that can be justified.
So what about if you try to do this in a different way through, for example, making childcare tax deductible? What are the pros and cons of that sort of model?
If you instead went to a world where childcare is tax deductible, you would be very significantly increasing out-of-pocket costs for low and middle-income earners. Because they don't pay a huge amount of tax, it would very much cap the level of the benefit they would receive. So it would be a backward step in my mind. So if you went from the current system to pure tax deductibility, the only winners would be very high-income earners, and you'd actually be a big step backwards for low and middle-income earners. So I don't think that's a very good idea at all.
What about a mixed system?
It's just more complicated. So people have proposed this idea that you could keep the current system and you could opt in to tax deductibility. You know, honestly, if you're a family with young children running around, you want to be sitting there trying to, forecast your future earnings and work out your tax liability and work out which system you're going to be better off under. I mean, it's incredibly complex. I think a much better idea is keep the system we have, but improve it so that you're actually creating those incentives there for women to work more if they want to.
Now, back a few decades, Australia was among the first countries in the world to produce a women's budget statement back in 1984. The process was scrapped in 2014 by the coalition government, and this government has sort of brought it back in a limited way with a statement of measures specifically directed at women. Is there a case for restoring a proper gender impact statement that would look at the impact of all the measures in the budget on women?
Yes, I think there is. And I think, you know, for the reasons I said before, you know, it's important to look at the budget overall through different lenses, and it just helps make sure that you haven't missed something. So, you know, I suspect if you had done that in this budget and you'd done that distributional analysis, someone would have said, oh, goodness me, you know, it looks like a lot of the measures are skewed towards industries where, you know, there are a lot of men. We're not doing a lot for these other sectors. So I think it would have, you know, sounded the alarm, and you may well have actually ended up with a better, more rounded budget if we'd done that. So I would love to see that returned. It's really important it includes that actual analysis of the impact of the budget measures, because that's what is going to alert to people if something looks out of whack.
Would you think that no one in Treasury made that point on the way through?
Who knows? So, I think if you don't have a systematic process for actually running the distributional analysis, it is possible that it got missed. It may be that some people sounded the alarm, but what you actually want is those distributional numbers sitting there, you know, in front of the Treasury Secretary, in front of the Treasurer, because that's, you know, really what's going to drive it home.
Were you surprised that this gender debate has broken out around this budget? I don't remember it so strongly in previous budgets. And do you think that this will change things for the future?
It certainly has broken out very strongly this time around, but I think that's actually in response to the fact that, one, we know that women were, you know, particularly hard hit by the COVID recession, particularly early on. And I think just that the budget just didn't reflect that reality. So it was the sort of the disconnect between people know what's happening in the economy versus the way in which the budget lined up with that. So I think that's, you know, really what explains the strength of the reaction. And I look, I do hope that it will change things for the better. I think that, you know, that the importance of that gender lens and looking at those distributional impacts has, you know, hopefully come out loud and clear. And, you know, I would certainly hope decision makers think twice about the importance of doing this in future. So, you know, if what came out of this, it was a greater commitment to looking at that particular lens, to doing that distributional work, even better, including it in the budget papers themselves, that would be a fantastic outcome.
Danielle Wood, thank you very much for being with us to talk us through this important debate. And that's all from today's Conversation Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.